All right, a pleasure after a little bit of a hiatus traveling to Japan and Israel and taking advantage of a sabbatical this semester. It's a pleasure to welcome back Dr. Mark. We will be starting a totally new series and a little bit different than what we tend to do. Most of what we've done, has been great rabbinic figures. We have exceptions to books here and there, exceptions. And of course, but now we're going to discuss the Musar controversy. Of course, we'll discuss some of the great figures involved, but we'll spend a number of weeks. It's hard to believe that there was a controversy about Musar, but Dr. Shapiro will explain why that was. Okay, that a half-decent introduction to lay the foundations for our next number of weeks?
Yes,
okay. Indeed. And in fact, the comment you just made is the exact same comment made by Rechiel Yaakov Weinberg. He says that, well, we'll see it today, that no one could believe today, basically, why there would be a controversy. So
you are going to tell the look who thinks is a Nebuch joke, right?
I didn't hear.
You are going to tell the look who thinks he's a Gornish joke.
Well, that's really about Musar. That's not about the Musar controversy. But I'll tell the joke if you want. I've told the joke before. The truth is, we are going to talk about Nevardik because we're going to see the Chazon Ish's critique of Musar, and that relates to Nevardik, at least in some part of it. And so then I'll tell that. But I'm interested in a different issue for the most part, but we'll get to all that as well. First, yes, thank you all for being here. Originally, the plan was to continue with Great Torah Sages, Gedol Yisrael. In fact, I have already classes ready done for Rav Shmuel Molliver, important figure, founder of religious Zionism. But we had a request from our dear friend, Rabbi Yaakov Yellen, to do the Musar disputes. So that's what we're going to do. I can't say how long it's going to be. As you know, we will just we'll keep going and going and going till we finish. I have to say, and as words of introduction, these classes, of all the classes I've done, and we've now many hundreds, I don't know if anyone would say that they prefer I didn't do any of them. Maybe someone doesn't like Satmar, so they say I shouldn't have done the Satmar already, or reform movement. Why do we have to deal with the reform movement? Maybe, but I doubt it. But these classes, I think there are probably a lot of people who feel that we shouldn't discuss them. This was clearly Rabbi Schwab's view, the Rav of the Washington Heights community, because he has an essay in which he says that when we think about the past, we should only be inspired. We shouldn't deal with the controversies and the disputes and wait till you see some of these controversies. But his attitude is, he says that we should basically cover this up. It doesn't inspire people. It's for antiquarian interest. We should focus on things that inspire us. Although we'll see in a minute why Rabbi Chaim of Weinberg says that this is very important to do. Before we get into what Rabbi Weinberg and others say, I think it's important for another reason, because we are going to see great Torah sages, Gedol Yisrael, who at the end of the day were wrong. Were terribly wrong, at least I say so, in their judgment of Musar. And when you look at it in retrospect, you have to ask yourself, why were they so exercised about it? Why was it so controversial? Look, I know if you're a chassid, you look at the dispute misnagdim and chassidim, you'll say the same thing about the great misnagdish rebbes, that they were all wrong and it showed they were mistaken. I think, though, however, the misnagdim today would say, no, they weren't wrong. They were right. I'm not saying that, but I think when it comes to the Musar dispute, I think everyone will agree that the great Torah scholars who said such shocking things, you'll be amazed to hear it, that they were wrong, that history has shown that they were wrong. And I think this is valuable also to see how great Torah scholars could make mistakes. Look, we're living in an era where if you follow the news, recently, coming out of Israel, you've heard unquestionably great Torah scholars say things which are just insane, in my opinion, outrageous. be it that the Haredim should get up and leave Israel if they, you know, they might have to do that, or the leader of the Lithuanian Torah world in Israel saying that yeshiva students, not only don't they go to the army, not only don't they do any shirut lelumi, they shouldn't go to funerals, they shouldn't go visit the sick, they shouldn't do any of these things. I mean, these are things that's just hard for us to grasp. But I think if we understand history, we can know that that there have been great Torah sages who said all sorts of things that in the past we look at, we can understand at the time. And this figure I just mentioned, Rabbi Dov Lando, I could say his name. You can also see videos of him sitting with the families, the hostage families, the irreligious, and reciting Tehillim. So we're not dealing with some person with no sensitivity, or we're not dealing with that at all. This is not like the person a few weeks ago who said that we should treat the soldiers like we treat the garbage men. You know, that we're not talking about that at all. We're talking about a man who loves all Jews, but he could say things that from our perspective, and I could explain if there's an interest later, why he would say such a shocking thing, like a yeshiva student shouldn't go visit the soldiers who were injured or anything like that. But we're going to see similar type of statements that will be shocking. And I think it helps us appreciate that even great Torah scholars could say things that we find very strange and we can't accept. And in the future, I think everyone will find this as well. Now, there's a lot of the matters we're going to deal with. There's a lot of revisionist history. There's a lot of phoniness. So, for instance, just to give you one example, here's a book. It's an autobiography by a rabbi named Dov Cohen. Interesting person, by the way. He comes from Seattle, and his mother sends him to go learn in Israel when he's young. Almost unheard of to do something like that. And he becomes, not a good old Yisrael, but a big Talmud Chacham. He was a chaplain in the, I think, in the Air Force, in the IDF. So he was in the Chevron, and he knew Rav Kook. He knew all the Gedolim. So it's a very interesting story of his life. I think it was translated to English. It's the subtitle is, you know, an enchanting journey of 100 years of Jewish life in Lithuania, America, Chevron, in quotations, that is Yeshiva Chevron, and Jerusalem. I like this book very much. But on page 116, he says as follows. Is it 116? He quotes the Saba of Slobodka, someone who we'll get to know. How could you, the Saba of Slobodka, disagree with Gedolim who opposed the Musar movement? And what did the Saba say? Hacholkim al Musar einam yacholim liyos gedolei ador. Those who opposed Musar are not able to be Gedolim. But the truth is, I don't know if the Altar of Slobodka said that or not. The truth is that they were Gedolim. You'll find this false portrayal that the people who opposed it were Ketanim. They were not the Gedolim. It's not true, though. You're going to see many Gedolim. We're going to be, that part of what I'm going to do is introduce you to a lot of these figures, some of whom are totally forgotten today, but in their lifetimes, they were Gedolim Yisrael. And that's part of things. Things we're going to see. So why would people oppose studying about this? Well, first of all, not only because you're going to see great rabbis make mistakes, but you're going to see the fighting, the back and forth, the disputes. We're going to see all sorts of strong language from rabbis, and I think there are people who will say that this is disrespectful. To recall this, that this rabbi called that rabbi this and that. However, Rabbi Dov Katz disagrees. Who's Rabbi Dov Katz? Well, we're going to be with him throughout this whole course because he wrote this book. Unfortunately, it hasn't been, or fortunately, depending on perspective, it hasn't been translated to English. It's Pulmus HaMusar. The title page doesn't say the date, but it's 1972. He wrote 5 volumes on the Musar movement called Tznuat HaMusar. You can order this, by the way. You can just click on where it says order print version, and you can get, even from Amazon, you can get it in softcover if you want. And after 5 volumes, all about the Musar movement, its personalities, its ideas. These are classic works. He then wrote this work on the controversy, all the controversies. And it's basically what this work is. And we're going to follow it. I'm going to use this as my basic text and then go off in all, as is my wont, in all sorts of different directions and clarify things. And he doesn't do the entire Musar movement. For example, there's nothing in there about the Chazon Ish, about Rav Kook. But that'll be the basic text I'm going to be using. It's basically a source book. In an era before they had copy machines, I think, in the early 70s, he must have had some sort of copy, because what he does here is basically reprint the various back and forth of the Rabbanim, the Gedolim. He doesn't just summarize it. He actually prints, like, for pages. This article appeared in this newspaper. That article appeared in this newspaper. He must have been, although his job was, he ran the Batei Din in Jerusalem. That was his position. For the chief rabbinate, he was the person in charge of the Beis Din there. So he was obviously in close contact with many great Gedolim, but, he must have spent an enormous amount of time in the library. It's not like today, where, for example, later today, we're going to see this newspaper, Hamelitz, important Haskalah newspaper. If you want to know what's going on in Eastern Europe, you have to look at it. But before the digitization, you had to go to the library. You had to sit with the old newspapers and go through page after page to find all these things. He did all that. And so it's a very valuable book. Well, he picks up right at the beginning, explaining, because obviously people disagree, why he wrote this book, why he's bringing back from the dead, as it were, 80 years before, 90 years before, these disputes that no one today knows about, the details that maybe some people know that there was a dispute about Musar, but the nitty-gritty to bring it back to life, Chaye HaMesim, from most people would think let it rest. So he has to explain this in the introduction. And I'll tell you what he says right at the beginning in his preface. You know, I was interested in this book for many years. Here's the copy I have. You can see. Hold on a second. Can you? Actually, you can't see. Here's my copy. What is it? I got someone to make a copy all the pages and then sort of bind it for me in a primitive binding, because I needed this book for my study on Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg. And it hasn't been reprinted, and I don't know if it's going to be reprinted, but this is what he, other than the photo offset, this is what he says in the introduction as justifying what he's doing. So, well, first he has a preface, and then he has an introduction. He says that there are, this is what Rabbi Kelman was mechaving to. He says that when you look in Jewish history, you find certain partial, that's what he calls it, chapters that raise wonder. because they apparently, tell me how I'm doing. That when you read these stories, when you learn about what happened in the past, it apparently, is pogea. I don't know how to, it causes problems, I guess. Makes us look negatively. It damages, I guess, yes, the reputation of certain great Torah sages. And even though we know that this dispute was, as he says, l'shem shamayim, no question that what we're going to see was l'shem shamayim. These are different views of how Judaism should be. And in the midst of the dispute, we have very strong language because they felt strongly about it. He says, nevertheless, this people don't come out looking so well. And he says, it occurred to me to not deal with this at all. But he said that if I were to do this, this would create an impression that I'm covering things up. I'm censoring. But wait a second. A lot of people think that's exactly what he should do. Someone I know wrote a whole book about censorship. For many people, that's a whole philosophy. But he says he doesn't want to do that. He says that it would give the impression that I'm covering up for one side or the other, and therefore no one would rely on me anymore. And it's a good point. I mean, if you can write five volumes in the Musar movement and never speak about the dispute, you start to wonder how reliable Dov Katz is. And then he says, furthermore, in the opinion of great Torah scholars, and we'll see who some of these great Torah scholars are in a minute. Ein shum ish rashay lashmit b'divrayim shegadolei Torah eile. No one is permitted to censor the words of these great Torah scholars. That's what he said. He's been told by great Torah scholars, we don't have the permission to censor, even though we don't accept what they say. And history and time has shown that they were wrong in their worry that the Musar movement was going to lead to sectarianism, all these things. History has shown that was incorrect. Nevertheless, they were L'shem Shamayim, and their words are Torah, just like the words of the people who opposed the Rambam. We're not going to censor those, even though we don't accept their position that the about the Rambam's works, unless you're a Breslov or Chassid. I don't think anyone holds of the opponents of the Rambam today. Yeah, but we don't cover it up. I've repeated this many times because, as many of you know, I've written certain things and I've discussed what certain great rabbis have said. And some people said, well, how could you say that? And I've said that it's not from me. I asked a great, someone I respect very much, and he said these same words. Maybe he got them from Dov Katz, that we don't censor the words of Gedolei Torah. We don't censor the words of Gedolei Yisrael. And then he goes on. Since these great Torah scholars at their time, through the koach, the strength of their Torah, and their responsibility for what they felt was, you know, the direction of Torah in their society, they thought it was appropriate to say what they said. Therefore, we too can learn from this. And I, the author, have decided not to cover this up, including bituyim charifim biyoter shel rabbanim mesuyamim, even very sharp statements. We'll see that at least in one case, he says, I'm not going to tell you, I'm going to leave out a tiny bit of what they say, but I'll tell you what he left out. Why? He says, because their Das Torah came, these sharp words came from their Das Torah, and these sharp words, he tells us, were common in earlier days. We're much more dainty today. We're much more sensitive. Yet in previous generations, it's called the Risa de Araisa. When Rabbanim would argue with each other, they would let him have it. That's and the Gemara. We have examples in the Gemara of this as well. So that's, he says, therefore, we can't cover this up. And those who understand, who are sophisticated, will look at what I'm going to show you and understood it in the correct light, that this is all being done L'shem Shamayim. Then, so that's the, in his, really, it's a preface, we'll call it Haktama. But then in chapter one, he picks up the matter again to try to explain what's going on here, because it is a strange phenomenon that, from our perspective, he says, he begins by explaining, again, a Haktama, an introduction to what we're going to see here. He says that every time you've had a new idea in Judaism, even if it seems like totally fine, there's always going to be opponents to it. Then you could go down the list. Dafyomi. What's not more popular today than Dafyomi? I mean, everyone's doing Dafyomi. It's people who can't even, don't even know Hebrew. There are people who don't know Hebrew when they say, or Aramaic, and they say they finish Shas. Well, they have with the art scroll. But there were opponents to Dafyomi. The Rambam Yomi. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, do the Rambam Yomi. It's opponents to that. Every idea, there's been opponents to. Rabbi Teitz, when he started teaching Torah on the radio, there were opponents to it. You can't teach. I mean, all these sorts of things. The things we, obviously, the internet. When the internet, you're going to teach Torah on the internet and all the, everything, newspapers. People oppose newspapers, take away the newspapers, say the Haredi world has no way to communicate with its followers. That's the greatest source of passing on the message is through newspapers. So Rabbi Dov Katz begins, he's a Sabbatka person, by the way, so he's clearly a partisan of Musar, but he's going to be very in the book. He tries to be very dispassionate. He says every new idea in every tkufa, every era, has created vikuchim charifim, you know, strong controversy, and even things that were, that we consider today basic. He says, like hakira, philosophy, Kabbalah, Hasidut, all these were of great benefit to Torah Judaism. they expanded our perspective. They added a great deal, and yet they met with controversy. And he says, only after a certain amount of time has passed and things have settled, can we look at it, you know, from the perspective of the future, look back, and we can see, you know, well, why there were these disputes and understand why these things, which now we value and we treasure, succeeded, basically. They weren't pushed aside by the controversy. On the contrary, they're very positive. And he says that we find the same thing with the Mussar movement. And of course, I'll talk a little bit about what the Mussar movement is in a few minutes. He says that we had what he calls a pilug ritzini, a serious dispute, not dispute, break between the rabbis. And this continued into the Torah centers. We're going to see what happened in the yeshivas. Some of the stories I'll tell you, you'll be amazed what was going on in the yeshivas themselves. And he says in the coming chapters, I'm going to lay it all out for you in all its pratim and chiluke deot and the disagreements. And people will ask, why do we need to bring this all up, like from the archives? Because it's all been forgotten now. And there's no footprint of it in today's world. No one still mentions this, so why bring it up? And then he says, first of all, you can ask this question to every historian and every archaeologist. Why engage in such efforts? It's not such a good, to bring back something which has already passed. I mean, it's not such a good point, I think, because we're dealing with Torah matters here, but okay. But he says the reason is that we can learn a lot from history. And he says exactly what I says, from the achievements and also from the shkiyot and the kishlonot, from the mistakes that these great rabbis made, we are going to learn from. Now, what I just said maybe is heresy for many people, or some people. But this is what Rav Dov Katz says. We're going to learn from the mistakes.
Fuck,
and he says, we
man,
don't...
Just pure yep. fuck.
Now, I'll wait to the end. Okay, hold on to the questions to the end. He says, we don't build the present and the future without the nisyonos, he says, of the past. Without the experience of the past, we cannot build our future. And he says, the Torah itself told us this. What does the Torah say? Zechari mos olam. Remember the past days. Bina shel star vador. We have to know the past. Ask your father and he will tell you. Ask the elders. And he says further, we know Chazal tell us that history repeats itself. Actually, not history. The Tanakh tells us, Ecclesiastes, what was will be. And what was, you know, that we know that. It's in the Pasuk there. Mashahaya hushiyya. And therefore, we need to know, by knowing the past, we can be, he says, we can be prepared for the present and the future challenges. So he's given a couple different explanations as to why we need to know this. And he says, in particular, from the Machlokas, the dispute over Mussar, we can learn a lot. First of all, we can learn a lot from the critics, and we can learn from those who defended that. Because we'll see that even during the dispute, the adherents of Mussar would themselves learn from their mistakes. They weren't perfect either. And each part of Mussar, each Mussar school tried to improve on the past. Now, interestingly, in the footnote here, he gives an example. I've mentioned this before. If those who are with me have heard it. He quotes something from Baruch Epstein in the Makor Baruch, the son of the Aruch HaShulchan. It's famous. What Baruch Epstein says, I think it's completely fraudulent, but it's famous, this statement. When he quotes the, he has a conversation. If you look in the Makor Baruch, which is, Makor Baruch has everything. It's his autobiography. It's his Torah studies. It's a mishmash of the most interesting stuff. The question is, how much of the autobiography is authentic? There's good reason to believe, I've written about it, that there's a lot in the autobiography which he has created for contemporary reasons. And this is an example. He has a whole chapter there with a dialogue between his father, the Aruch HaShulchan, and the Tzemach Tzedek. The Tzemach Tzedek is the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, important figure, and the Aruch HaShulchan was first a Rav in a town, Novozibkov. Novozibkov is the town of my grandfather. step-grandfather. It was a Chabad town. So there's all these Chabad, that was before he went to Nevada. We're going to go back to Aruch HaShulchan because he becomes a big defender of the Musarniks. Because he was the Rav of Nevardik, and Nevardik is the one they love to hate. And so we'll see what the Aruch HaShulchan says. But so you have this whole story there, and it's become famous. The Hasidim love to quote the story. And I'm just writing something down to check. And then he says as follows. And it's amazing because Baruch Epstein isn't there, but he can tell you the entire conversation word for word. And when the Tzemach Tzedek nodded and this and that, it's clearly, it could be that the basic details are correct, that he was told this by his father, and he's just turning it into an interesting story. It's like lots of, so look at lots of biographies. Next time you read a biography, look how they can tell you that so-and-so walked in the room and he stood up and risked. How do they know all this? They don't know all this. They're creating a story. But I think the whole, I don't accept it at all. I mean, none of them is not being accepted, but I have other reasons not to accept it. But he tells as follows that the story he's told here that the story is that hold on a second that the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Tzemach Tzedek, supposedly said that we have to be very thankful for the fact that the Vilna Gaon opposed us so and persecuted us, because had it not been for the Vilna Gaon's opposition, who knows what would have become of us? So, okay. Now, what can I tell you? I said the opposite. It's the Mistagdim likes to cite this. The Hasidim hate this. It's impossible to imagine that the Tzemach Tzedek ever would have said this. The Hasidim never would acknowledge that the Vilna Gaon's. Remember, who was the Vilna Gaon criticizing? He refused to meet with the Baal HaTanya. He slammed the door in his face, and the Baal HaTanya came to Vilna to meet with him. The idea that that any chassid, Kal v'chomer, all the more so that the Tzemach Tzedek would say that we have to be thankful for what he says, the chesed gadol asher asay imanu hagra, that the great, the gra who persecuted them, that we have to be thankful for that. It's impossible it could ever happen. Okay, but he cites this. He's citing this as an example. He takes it seriously that he's a misnagid. Misnagid likes to hear this, that we can learn a good deal from critiques. And then he says the same thing happened with the Musar movement, that the opposition that we're going to see help the Musar movement in certain ways from going in incorrect directions. And therefore, we can learn a lot from it. And finally, he says, there's another important reason to study all this, because there was a lot of distortions of Musar written by the Maskilim. And we need to cite all this so that later historians don't look at that and assume it's correct. So we want to correct it. I'm actually in this course, if you want to call it this, I'm not going to be focusing on the criticisms of the Maskilim. He goes into that as well. I'm not so interested in that. I want to focus on the Gedol Yisrael, the Rabbanim back and forth. But he has a whole chapter here dealing with the Maskilim. And finally, he says that he was told by Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, after Rabbi Weinberg received the third volume, he wrote this, Rabbi Weinberg had passed away, 66, after Rabbi Weinberg received the third volume of his work, the Tnuas HaMusar, Rabbi Weinberg wrote to him and says, in my opinion, it's incumbent upon you to also describe the Machokas HaMusar V'Tanos Misnagdav, the dispute, the Musar dispute, and the critiques of its opponents, because it's appropriate for a historian not to cover up any side. And therefore, and Rabbi Weinberg himself is the first one to write about the Musar dispute. I'll read you what he says, maybe today, if not today, next class. So here, Rabbi Weinberg tells him, Rabbi Weinberg, who comes from the Musar movement, not only does he come from the Musar movement, there's just I wrote about his history. But I, there's a Masters that just came out. I can send it to anyone. 2021, someone in Israel who, it's great reading about, you know, I'm first generation, 1999, my book appears. Now we're the second generation. I inspired this whole master's dissertation, but it's all new stuff, basically. It's situating, it's Ben-Gurion University, the person, as I recall. I'm reading it right now because I just got it. Situating Rabbi Weinberg as a Mussar personality. As I didn't really portray him as a Mussar personality, but so the whole master's dissertation, I don't know, I guess it's about 100 pages, is all about Rabbi Chaya of Weinberg as a Mussar partisan and what he brings to the table in that. So quite fascinating. So here we have a Mussar personality, one of the closest students of the Altar of Sabotka, a figure I'll introduce you to soon, Naftali Seyud of Berlin, and he's telling Dov Katz, you need to write the whole story. And he himself, Rabbi Weinberg, is the first one to write about the Mussar dispute. He wrote about it in 1950, 49. He wrote about the first one to ever write about it in like a dispassionate, objective, outside fashion. Not, obviously, people wrote back and forth, but they were defending their positions. He wrote about it. Second of all, he tells us that Rabbi Yecheskel Sarna, the Rosh Yeshiva of Hebron, the Hebron Yeshiva is Sabotka. It's Sabotka when it went on Aliyah. He said to me as well that I have to write about this without leaving out any prot, any detail, the consequences be what they be. So that's Dov Katz. What else can we say? Okay, I told you we're going to follow Dov Katz and we're going to get into things that he doesn't discuss as well. The question, the first initial question we have to ask is, what could be wrong with Mussar? That's what we're going to have to try to understand. And if you told the average person on the streets, they go into the average yeshiva. I think this is pretty much like hidden information, as far as I know. You go into the average yeshiva student and say, well, you know, some people didn't like this whole Mussar thing Rosh Santo is trying to do. I don't think they'll know what you're talking about. What could be wrong with it? What is Mussar, after all, other than trying to create a close connection to God, to focus on Yirat Shamayim and personal ethics, to make you a more complete Jew in all facets? Isn't that what people have been doing and been striving for since the beginning of time? Don't we have examples in the Talmud? In medieval times, we have a whole literature. Don't we have classic works, Mesilas Yesharim? We have medieval works as well. We'll see some of them. So on the face of it, this is quite strange. Someone would oppose this idea that we're trying to... What is the Rambam's Hilchos Deos? What is Rabbi Bachya ibn Pakuda, the Cholos Lavavos? Don't we have a whole tradition of self-improvement? So how can anyone oppose that? Why would there be an opposition? I need to make a point here. The word Mussar in modern Hebrew means ethics or morality. That's not what it means for us, and that's not what it means in Rabbinic Hebrew. Rabbinic Hebrew could have a few meanings. I mean, if I say to you, I'm going to give you Mussar, it means I'm going to give you rebuke or something like that, teach you. But that's not what Mussar means for the Mussar movement, for Rosh Hashanah. Mussar does not mean ethics or morality because that has a Ben Adam L'Chavero sense. When we think of Mussar in that sense, that morality or ethics, we think of man and his fellow man. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter had a big focus on that. No question about it. In fact, one of his major points was that the major problem that we deal with is that people have created a bifurcation in Torah, that they're very much focused on the Bein Adam L'Makom, mitzvot between man and God, but not on man and his fellow man. And it's an amazing thing, Rabbi Yisrael said, that people can be completely oblivious to the problems of their neighbors and yet consider themselves pious. So that was one of his major points. However, that's not what Mussar is only about. Mussar is about self-improvement, you're creating in all aspects of religious life, making yourself a better Jew. You have to work on your own Yirat Shamayim and various exercises on this. It's all encompassing, I would say. You know, there's a story. I don't know. I mean, a lot of these, you don't know if they're apocryphal, but it's a good, the story is that just to show you the stress on Ben Adam Chaveru, I cited in a previous class a good story about this, but I'll tell you a different story. This is the story that was told as to how Rav Yisrael Salanter saw that there was a need for a Musar movement. I'm not sure it's a true story because, as I said, if you look at the early writings, he doesn't have a stress on Ben Adam Chaveru, a man and man. He's he himself doesn't have this bifurcation. The stress is just as much on how you connect to God, Ben Adam Makom. But there's a story that said as follows, and it's been misunderstood, so we should set it out there, that Rav Yisrael was once in a shul on Yom Yoroim, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, whatever, and he didn't have a sitter, demachzor. There wasn't enough. It's not like today. Again, it's sort of story that it's like these various stories, like the Vilna Gaon was at an inn and he met someone, you know. Was the Vilna Gaon actually going around to inns? I mean, maybe in his early years when he went into Golis, as they say. But a lot of these stories are when how many Gedolim, they met this Gadol on a train. And whatever. It's not important if it happened. But the story is as follows, that so he leaned over someone's shoulder to look at the machzor, to share with him. And the person gave him a dirty look and walked away. He didn't want to share his machzor. And, I forgot to say, so Rav Yisrael looked around and he saw someone who was davening with great kavana, I guess the shuckling and doing everything. And he said, well, that's a person I should lean over his shoulder. You know, if I'm close to him, he has such kavana, such devekus, whatever it is, it'll, could, you know, blow off on me. And when he tried to lean over the guy's shoulder, the person gave him a dirty look and walked away. So some people have seen this story as teaching that, well, and Rav Yisrael supposedly after that said that he realized something was very wrong. And he set upon himself to try to fix Kal Yisrael. So some people have told the story that what Rav Yisrael Salanter saw was that there was a hypocrisy, a phoniness. This guy, he looks like he's all pious, but really it's a fraud. But that's not the meaning of the story. No, the man really was pious, and he really did have real davening, and he really did have a connection. And that's the distortion was that you could have such a connection in your Bein Adam L'Makom, in your tefillah, and at the same time have no connection to your fellow neighbor. That's what the tragedy was and why it was such a problem that there had been. We know examples of this. Someone could eat super glatt kosher and be super pious and all these things, but his Ben Adam Chaveru, he could look, he could be in I forgot the name of it, the prison where you get the glatt kosher meat and the Chol of Yisrael, wherever, you know. Otisville, yes. Otisville was established, Dafka, because they needed a place where all these people would only eat the Hamish Hashkachas. So they had to establish this place, Otisville, just for these people. Now there's other people in it as well. So, I mean, this is a big problem, obviously. Now, there's also an important point about this dispute that we're going to see. Unlike the Hasidic Misnagdic dispute, this was a dispute that would have gone over most people's heads. If you were living in Lithuania in the 18th century, the end of the 18th century, you knew about this dispute. The masses knew about this. Look, the Hasidim were the masses. Everyone knew about this. The Musar dispute, this is a dispute of intellectuals in the yeshivas. If you're living in a typical small Lithuanian town, just a regular one of the masses, you have no idea about this dispute. It doesn't affect you. If you're Navardic, you know, because the yeshiva's there. But most people had no knowledge of this. It was a dispute of intellectuals for intellectuals. It took place in yeshiva. So although the rabbis get very excited over these matters, this really wasn't an issue. The whole Musar movement is a movement for elites. Rav Yisrael wanted it for the masses. He wanted to bring everyone. But at the end of the day, we're dealing with elite sort of things. So that, I think, is worthy of note as well. Now, as I said, and I'm going to go for maybe 10 more minutes, and then I still have a few comments to make from the last time we met, but I didn't want to begin with this because I wanted to get right into it. And then, as usual, beginning next week, I will start always with the various comments. Rav Yaakov Weinberg, is the first one to discuss the Mussar movement. So, you know, maybe, you know, we're getting right into the Mussar movement, the dispute of the Mussar movement. Really, maybe we should have had classes on the Mussar movement. I'm taking it for granted, which I probably shouldn't, that most people have some idea of it, but I mean, that's probably a mistake. So let me just briefly describe what this is, and we'll learn more about the Mussar movement as we go through. But in the 19th century, there was a great rabbi, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. He wasn't just a great rabbi in terms of what he accomplished in the Mussar movement. He was a great Talmud Chacham. If he wanted to be, he could have been a great posei. He could have been a rav of a city. But he saw there was a problem. He saw that Jews were not living complete Jewish lives. They were lacking in their connection to God and the connection to mitzvot. So he came up with ways to try to improve this. He created a Mussar house, basically. It's where you could go in Kovno, and you could study Mussar. He recommended various exercises, things to do, and he himself traveled. He went to Germany. He went to Paris. He was trying to create a revolution, basically, which to a certain extent he did. If you look at all the great yeshivas today, they all have Mussar in it, or most of them, I should say, and Mussar became an important part of many of the great yeshivas. You think of Mir, you think of Sabatka, you think of Telz, not without the disputes that we'll see as well, and the idea being that it's not enough just to learn Gemara. It's not enough just to learn Halacha. Some people thought that's enough. If you just learn Gemara, that'll put you in good stead with God, with your fellow Jews. No, it's not enough. You need to work on yourself in other ways so you don't fall into the traps. So you have to work on your midos. You have to, look, we can go on forever talking about this, and there's different schools of Mussar that come out of this. How to do this? You have the Slobodka school, you have the Navardic school. There's a lot to say, but that would take us itself 100 classes. So what we're going to do is we'll learn about this. Just go to Wikipedia. You can read all about the Mussar movement. I'm assuming we know about the Mussar movement. And how can anyone have a problem with working on yourself to be a better person? Okay. The first person to discuss this matter, as I said, is Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, the great Sri Deish. And he himself doesn't discuss it as a partisan, as dispassionately, as I said. I want to read you what he says in this 3DH. Incidentally, some of you might have seen, I have a new blog post coming out soon. And the plan was, just like you remember, some of you do at least, my last blog post, the first color pictures ever of Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg. So I was supposed to do the first color video ever of Chiyak of Weinberg, not just the first color video, the first video ever to appear. And I even had someone, I was sent this like off the record, and I had the guy here and other things in it. I had him create, it comes from his family's collection. He created a nice, like a 4-minute video at my request, so I'll thank him for that. But whatever, he sent it to some people, and then it got spread around the whole world. Some of you probably saw it, because I got a lot of video. I got a lot of emails from people sending the video saying, "Have you seen this?" And I'm like, "Have I seen it? I'm the reason it exists. I told him to put it together." But if you haven't seen it, stay tuned, and you'll see it soon. And great pictures, and I'll also, because I have to throw in something new pictures of Ruchiach of Weinberg that no one has seen. Not color, but pictures from before the war, pictures from between World War I and World War II. So Rabbi Weinberg, look, he comes out of Slobodka, very close student of the Alter Slobodka, Nassim Zvi Finkel, the first one to write, or the second one, I guess you'd say, to write quasi-academic type articles on the Mussar movement. In German, he wrote it. He's the first one. Second one, I should say. There was one other person who was writing, but he's writing as someone on the inside. He is the one, Rabbi Weinberg is the one who actually, he's the first one, as far as I know, to say this, which then becomes popular, that the idea that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who was a genius, he understood human nature, and he talks about that he anticipated Freud in discovering the unconscious. Rabbi Weinberg is the first one to mention this. And then this becomes like a standard thing in the Mussar world that, you know, Rousseau Salanter You know, he even preceded Freud, Epicus, in his book, Aristotle deals with it and shows that it's not true, that they're talking about different things. Be that as it may, Rabbi Chaim of Weinberg is the first one. He writes about the altar, Aristotle, the altar, sepulcher of Pali Amsterdam, Yitzhak Blaser, all the great figures. And he also was the first one to write about the Machokas. This is the title of his article, Aha Machokas Neged Tnuas HaMusar, the dispute about Musar. And he says that, what do I want to tell you? He says that there's been in the 50s, in 1950, he writes this. He says that recently a lot of people have written about it, all about Musar. He says, but only a few know about the dispute that was fought against Musar. And he lived through it because in Slobodka, he was there when the Musar dispute split the yeshiva. Not only did it split the yeshiva metaphorically, it split the yeshiva literally. Two yeshivas in Slobodka. Do you know that there were two yeshivas in Slobodka? Not just one Slobodka. There were two separate yeshivas. One by the Alter Slobodka, or Moshe Mordechai Epstein, and the other was headed by Reb Baruch Ber Leibovich, the great Reb Baruch Ber. Reb Baruch Ber's yeshiva is anti-Musar. And the Slobodka yeshiva, the other one, is pro-Musar. We'll deal with all this. Rabbi Weinberg lived through this, and he writes about it. He says very few know about this. And he says that this dispute is not understood today, and even in the past. People wondered, Madua Bisnati Mushita Zo. How, why are people opposing this? Were they opposed to it only because it's something new? Chadash Asur Min HaTorah? Like Dov Katz said, that people are always going to oppose things that are new? He says, but it's not new. Oh, look in medieval times. Look at, you know, hundreds of years before the Musar movement. We have rabbis writing works that can only be considered Musar texts. So what about the Talmud? What about Midrash? He says, but we have a historical fact. During this dispute, great rabbis, Gedolei Rabbanei Litza, came out against the Musar movement. He says with a proclamation, which is very insulting. And he says that this proclamation says that you should separate yourself from the Musar students and to radfam b'chol minei redifos, to persecute them with all their persecutions, just like Rabbi Weinberg says the opponents of the Hasidim did to them. And he goes on to say that there are those who portray this as that the great rabbis of Lithuania were just small-minded people, and with bad midot, maybe jealous, all these sorts of reasons. That's where they portray. And he says that this is completely false. He says there were profound reasons for this dispute. And we will, starting next class, we're going to get right, this is all introduction, right into it. In fact, you know where we're going to begin? Where the Musar dispute begins. It begins in a place called Slutsk, which I'll introduce to you. But actually, I should say it begins before that, because already in Rabbi Yisrael's lifetime, there was opponents to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Actually, we have a few minutes, so let me give you some examples. First of all, when we speak about the Musar dispute, when Roy Weinberg speaks about the Musar dispute, he's speaking about something that begins in the late 1880s and continues into the first decade of the 20th century. It really ends by around 1905, 1906, before World War I. However, in reality, the conflict begins earlier, in the lifetime of Yisrael Salanter. Katz doesn't, he discusses in his book, you know, Musar, but not in the Musa Musar. In the Pumas Musar, it just begins in the 1880s. But really, you have to, I think, to understand this properly, you have to go back, because in Rav Yisrael's own lifetime, there was disputes. And now let me just give you a couple of examples of this. Now, he had people who opposed him for other matters. So, for instance, did you know that Rav Yisrael Salanter wanted to have translation of the Talmud and have it into German, into Russian, have it taught in the universities? He thought that would, if in those days, unlike today, where the universities have so debased themselves, it's unbelievable. But in those days, the university, people looked up to the universities. And you had so many Jews who had no interest in studying Talmud anymore. They thought it was something backwards. They wanted to go study science or economics, you know, at the university. But if the universities would teach Talmud, Well, that would give it a, in people's minds, this would now be thought to be a legitimate field of study, and they would take it seriously again. Well, as you can imagine, there are many rabbis were opposed to this. Well, we're going to bring Talmud into the universities. That's the last thing we want to do. Rabbi Shlomo Salanter had all sorts of ideas that people, women's education. Well, I shouldn't say women's education. So that he that's not something he did. On the contrary, he said that in Russia they're not ready for that. What he said that what Israel Hundesheimer did in Germany was good, but it's not for him. But well, we're going to see examples of a number of other things that Rishon Salanter did that people opposed. Famously, during the cholera epidemic, he got up and made kiddush, and everyone has to eat on Yom Kippur. Many of the rabbis oppose that. I'm talking about Musar, though. We find opposition to him on account of his Musar ideas. But that's not how they didn't oppose him in a Musar sense. They tried to tear him down. Let me just give you a couple examples. If you look in, Dov Katz's book, Tnuat HaMusar, volume one, page, 155, he tells a story. It's a famous story that in order to look, Rabbi Shlomo Salanter is not doing anything we would think so crazy. He's telling people. He starts telling people that they should study Masiyos Yesharim and Cheshbon HaNefesh of Mendel Lefin, and that these should be printed. By the way, this book of Cheshbon HaNefesh of Mendel Lefin. He was like a Moscow Mendel Lefin, but the Rabbi Shlomo Salanter thought this was okay because he had very good approach, exercises to how to get your life in order. The book actually is taken from Benjamin Franklin. It's a translation to Hebrew of Benjamin Franklin, who wrote a book also on it. And Leffen doesn't tell you that any more than Rabbi Dessler. Rabbi Dessler, in his, in the Michtam Eliyahu, a part of it is taken directly from Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. He doesn't tell you where he get it from because people will go crazy over that. So he says, he records here the story that there were people already in Rishon's lifetime who opposed this stress on Musar for reasons we'll get into when we deal with the later controversy. It hadn't yet come to fruition the way we're going to see with organized camps, but there were people who didn't like it. And what they did when Rishon's contract was, he would give shear. So what they did in one time is that, or more than once, they would, they got this genius student, and his job was to stay there. And when we saw who was giving a shiur, his job is to contradict him and to let the people know that Rabbi Shlomo Salanter is not such a good Lubi Torah. So if Rabbi Shlomo Salanter is up there in Vilna, let's say, or in Kovno, these are important cities with great Torah scholars, and you have this student, to use the Yiddish word, upschlugging, showing that Rousseau Salanter doesn't know what he's talking about, that his interpretations are incorrect, then people will lose their respect for him as one of the great rabbis, and he won't have any influence. But of course, as the story goes, Rousseau Salanter was such a great Torah scholar that he was able to turn the tables on this Mechutzof, this young whippersnapper. Also, if you look on page 329, you have the other famous story where Rabbi Shlomo Salanter sent out, he hung up a sign with, he's giving a shiur with the different makorot, the different sources he's going to do in this shiur. Well, so what happens? They replace it with different makorot. So he's going to do, let's say, a Masachas Ketubot, let's say, and he has all the sources. They put up Bab Metzia with different sources. Now, most people, they come there and they'd say, well, I can't do this. This isn't my shiur. Rabbi Shlomo Salanter sees it. Actually, he realizes this only when he's about to give the shiur. And it's mentioned that he stood there for a few minutes thinking, and then he gave an entire shiur with the makorot that the troublemakers put up there for him to trap him. He was able to give a shiur after a few minutes in his mind on that very topic. So whether these stories happened or not, I don't know. They're famous stories. The lesson, of course, in all this is that they tried to deal with Rabbi Shlomo Salanter. They couldn't because he was such a great Torah scholar. However, after Rabbi Shlomo's not around anymore, the next generation, then
it's time for them to really go to work, because if you do have great Torah scholars, but you don't have Yisrael Salanter. And that's what we're going to pick up next class. We're going to pick up, really pick up with this great dispute, which takes off in the city of Slutsk, a city that if we don't know, I'll introduce you to it, and with a shot across the bow by a figure who was great in his own day. We'll see if any of you have heard of him. And this shot across the bow, published in the Haskalah newspaper, Hameilitz, because Gedol Yisrael used to publish in that also, that begins the Musar dispute, which will then last for a couple of decades, with all its ups and downs. And wait, some of the things. Do you know that they threw the Musar books in the latrine in one yeshiva? That's how crazy this got. But we'll I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. Well, today was introduction, and so let me take the comments. Maybe I won't get I'll begin next class maybe with the things. I have a few things still remaining from last semester, but I see there's already a lot of comments, so let me get right to them. MJ, oh, hold on, I got it. MJ Frankel, you have, it looks like a recent print with a soft yellow cover. I think what you have is, if you go to HebrewBooks.org, you just click on where it says order it, that's what you have. It's just a photo offset. You can print all the books on HebrewBooks.org if they're over 75 years old. And even books that are not over 75 years old, if they decided to make them available, you can. That's all it is.
Yeah, I understand you can do that, but I did not do that. I can't recall at this point. Probably someone else did that, but
yeah, because it's not. As far as I know, it was never reprinted, but maybe it was. I've never heard of it. Thomas mentions Chaim Grada. Yes, we will deal. I'll deal with Chaim Grada. He's the record of some of the Chazon Ish, but we have the Chazon Ish in print. Is Chaim Grada forgotten? Chaim Grada is also, you're dealing with us elites here who know about Chaim Grada. Most people, you go to yeshiva, you ask them who Chaim Grada is, and you've heard of Chaim Grada. Even though Chaim Grada is what Professor Tversky said, the best description of the Chazon Ish there is, and all the Chazon Ishnikim in the yeshiva world, they agree that Chaim Grada's description, if you read Rabbi Yeshua Enbal, who's really the expert on the Chazon Ish today, he's always citing Chaim Grada, because of whatever Chaim Grada became, he knew the Chazon Ish and he had a way of portraying it. Moshe says that the reactionary attitude has been a blight on our history. We say Rav Burstein from Tavrig put it best. Yiddishkeit needs to be like a windmill. The base is stationary, but the fan changes direction with the wind. Well, it's very nice that the Tavrig Rav said that, Moshe, but we're going to see the Tavrig Rav was one of the great opponents of Musar. So maybe you're going to apply what you said to him to himself, because what he says, that the base is stationary, but the fan changed direction with the wind, I would say, with the benefit of hindsight, that he himself was not able to see this when it came to the Musar movement. And this Rav, the Tavrig Rav, was a great Gadol Bisrael. Who today has heard of him? Moshe's heard of him. But this was a man who was in the stratospheres. Rav Kook brought him to Merkaz HaRav to be Rosh Yeshiva there, and he passes away shortly after arriving there. Maybe that's why people haven't heard of him. He died young, but had he remained, he'd be one of the people we think about, one of the great Gadol Yisrael, but he's also a great opponent of Musar. So we'll see what he has to say later on. Now, Shmuel says, do I feel that Makor Baruch has too many fabrications to be relied on at all? Yes, I feel you can't rely on the Makor Baruch at all, because he's telling stories. There's a lot of books like this. He's telling stories. I love his Torah in it. It's some fascinating stuff, although he has some stuff that's problematic also. Rabbi, he's the source for this idea that Migdal Magdil. Why do we say Magdil during the weekday and Migdal on Yontif and Shabbos? He says because Shmuel Bet, that's where the word Migdal is. So somebody wrote Shmuel Bet, and therefore they misunderstood it to mean Shabbos. And then from there you go to Yom Tov. But we know that even before there was a division of Shmuel into Aleph and Bet, they had this minhag. Look, he's a great Talmid Chacham. He's the Torah Tamima. On the other hand, there's a lot. His history is not history. His history, in my opinion, is simply it's about the present. It's about creating these stories for whatever reason. And then there's also the problem of his plagiarisms. He's full of plagiarisms in the Torah Tamima and in the Makar Baruch. And I'm not the one to point that out. Many great Torah scholars have pointed this out. So he's a problematic figure. Chaim says Rabbi Munshine was of the opinion that the entire meeting was a figment of his imagination. Yes, he wrote, you can find the Munshine's piece online. It was published in the Sturm. I wouldn't say it is a figment of the imagination, but it's done for a reason. Just like his whole story about the Netziv's wife, the great Torah scholar there, which Munshine also showed couldn't have happened. And I added some pieces as well, but I think there's a reason for this story. He wants women to have more of an active role in Torah life, and therefore he creates a story. That's how I see it. Anyone who wants the dissertation on Rabbi Weinberg, just email me. I'll give it to you. I don't know what year Rabbi Dovkatz passed away. Look it up. In the 70s. 79. Thank you, Chaim. Nissen says, perhaps those who deem placing Tractate Brachot in the official Sky curriculum as not necessary because the students will learn it on their own also consider Musar not worthy of placement in a curriculum of scholarship. It's an interesting point, Nissen, but it's not historically correct because Volozhin, as we'll see, is the great center of anti-Musar. It's the one place where Musar cannot have entree, and yet in Volozhin, unlike the other great yeshivas, Volozhin learned the whole Talmud, starting in Brachos, going all the way through. Do you know that Yeshivas Rebbitz Elchanan YU follows Volozhin? This year, YU is learning all the Shirim, they're learning Brachos. That's not what you get if you go to the big, you know, Lithuanian yeshivas, but Volozhin, they didn't skip anything, and Yeshivas Rebbitz Elchanan doesn't.
In Emek Halacha, we learned Masechet Brachos, and we learned Musar also. I learned Brachos.
Emek Halacha is a special yeshiva because that was dedicated to practical halacha also. So, of course, my son, who's learning it now, says that's part of the problem because all the shiurim wanted them to focus on practical halacha. You know, he wants maybe more alumnus. So, but Emek Halacha was dafka designed for halacha. So, Brachos. Moshe says you could trace the Bein Adam HaChaver attitude back to Rav Chaim Volozhin, who's quoted by his son Rav Itzla as saying that a person was only created in order to do good to his fellow man. Yes, and Rav Yisrael Salant was, as you point out, a Talmud of Yosef Zundel of Salant, who was Rav Chaim Volozhin's Talmud. If you look at Tenuas Samusar of Dov Katz, Volume 1, probably like 80 pages or so, the beginning of it is devoted to not Rav Yisrael Salant, but Rav Yosef Zundel of Salant. And the whole point of he ends up in Yerushalayim at the end of his life. But the whole point of Dov Katz is that you can't understand Rav Yisrael Salant without knowing Rav Zundel of Salant. That's a good point. And also MJ Frankel says part of the Musar tradition. Oh, there you say it. Okay, Price tries to append Rav Yisrael Salant's perspective to Rav Zundel. Exactly. Okay, exactly what Moshe said, exactly what I was saying. And you say Rabbi Lamb takes a lot of that perspective to task. Lamb is speaking about Rav Chaim Volozhin, not Zundel. Now Moshe says the biography of the Minsker Gadol. We'll get to the Minsker Gadol later. It's a biography by a man named Halperin. It tells of his experience with the dispute. Yes, there's material in there about the dispute. Rav Moshe Yitzchak Avigdor of Kovno is quoted as saying, God forbid he's against learning Musar. What he was against was the movement in the house of the Musar. Okay, this is exactly what we're going to see next when we get into it. We'll explain what they were opposed to. No one was opposed to an individual learning a Mesilas Yesharim. That's not what it's about. We're going to see it's about a movement. It's about a whole separatist ideology. And then we're going to see it gets more complicated because you have a school like the Navardic school that for many of the Gedolim, that just is a false movement and is a distortion of Yisrael Salanter. In fact, the great opponents of Musra, as we'll see, claim that we are the supporters of Yisrael Salanter. It's you, Navardic, who've distorting Rav Yisrael Salanter. So we'll get to that as well. I don't need to talk about that now because we're going to get into it. Yes, Rabbi Yael, and the story of Yisrael Salanter making Kiddush.
he does have that. He shows that there's like five different versions of it. But I'm just, without getting into the detail, that's the famous story that everyone knows. Whether it happened or not, this is the famous story that everyone knows that. So yes, he does have the lecture. In fact, I was in that lecture in person when he gave that lecture in Torah in Motion. I was going to mention that later, that the whole story, although it's mentioned by Weinberg mentions it. It's mentioned by the next generation. So,
yeah, I commented later, and Rabbi Kelman pointed out what essentially some of what you said, and I commented later. I mean, I think if you listen to it, it's the only thing that makes sense with all the disparate versions that are totally, they are not consonant. They can't be that even two of those stories happen because they're diametrically opposed, and his explanation makes sense.
I forget what exactly. What is his final explanation? I don't even remember.
He says that there were the Maskilim who were trying to subvert the Yom Kippur, and they went around slapping these posters on in Vilna, which that they were there, and they were the ones who told the story. But he actually has, I think it was two eyewitnesses who explained exactly what happened. And he didn't make Kiddush. He said that if anyone is weak, they put cake out in the, like,
yes,
in the
Kiddush, yeah. He didn't get to say Kiddush.
But in fact, nobody took it.
I mean, the story is that after he did it, then another rabbi got up and rebuked him and things.
That's
so
those, true.
Yes, yeah. I encourage everyone to listen to Schneier's Lemon's talk. Mark says, how do you define muskil? Well, muskil is not spelled with a samech. It's spelled with a sin. It just means, actually, the opponents of the muskilim would spell with a samach sometimes because the word samach kaf lamed means fool. A muskil, in medieval times, a muskil just means someone who's intelligent, who's a philosopher. By the time you get to the 18th century, 19th century, a muskil is an enlightened Jew, a Jew who wants to update Judaism. And, a lot of things we do today, the Maskilim advocated. And there's different types of Maskilim, as we've spoken about. You have in Vilna, the Maskilim are all religious. The Shomer Shabbos, or most of them are, not all of them, but many of them are. When you go to places like Galicia in Germany, the Maskilim were irreligious. So Haskalah can mean a lot of different things. In fact,
Rabbi Solotar
was their leader.
When it's used as a pejorative like that, they're talking about people who...
No, when I use it, I'm talking about people who want to update Judaism and make it more modern. And
halachically or not so?
Halachically, well, some of them it could be halachic, but they want a rabbinical seminary. They want the yeshivas to be modernized, all these sorts of things.
Isaac Meir Weiss can be accused of that too.
Say again?
Isaac Meir Weiss can be accused of that too.
Isaac Meir Weiss was certainly a Maskil, 100%. And he was never regarded as an Orthodox Maskil.
I'm just trying to get the idea that apparently different people might be using it in different terms. In some cases, it seems to be less pejorative than others.
Yes. Vilna and Kovno were full of people who we call Maskilim. The Rashash's son, Rabbi Tisiel Strashon, whose notes are in the back of the Vilna Shas, was a Maskil. And yet he had a big long beard and was a goan in learning and was completely from Jew. But he was a Maskil. So a Maskil, any German Orthodox Jew, if he was transported into Vilna or Kovno, would be thought to be a Maskil. I'm sure Rafael Hirsch would be a Maskil in their mind. But a lot of the Maskilim were troublemakers because a lot of the Maskilim wanted to...
That's the sense you're using it.
Okay, Moshe asked about the motivation for publishing the Torah journal Tavuna. I don't know if we have a real explanation other than just he thought this would be a way to revitalize Torah through the give and take. Yes, Matt, we'll get to Rav Aaron Cutler. He's from Slutsk, but we're talking about an era long before Rav Aaron Cutler. Remember, Rav Aaron Cutler only is there because his father-in-law, Rav Isaal Meltzer, and Rav Isaal Meltzer is going to play a role in the dispute we're going to see next week. I don't need to anticipate, but let's just say the sages have an expression,
two kings can't wear one crown. And unfortunately, there happened to be two great rabbis in Slusk at the same time. And that's often a recipe for disaster. And we shall see. Okay.
Well, Moshe, you say Rabbi Yisrael Strassel is an eyewitness. The question is he an eyewitness to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter getting up and making kiddush, or is he an eyewitness to saying that everyone should eat if you don't feel well? You know, during this cholera epidemic, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, he had all his followers go work with these people, and they say that none of them got ill. Look, listen to Schneer Lyman. He has all the sources. And like I said, I was in person because both he and myself were there for that weekend. Rabbi Kellum probably remembers, and I heard him give that talk, but it's been many, many years, and I haven't heard it since. So I don't remember all the details about it.
That's exactly what I said.
All the versions of it are there.
Yeah, that's after release. And that was the one also Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelovich's grandson spoke.
Yes, of Torah.
That was a fascinating lecture too. But who Rav Shraga Feivel was. Okay, just once we're on the topic, we can go back and listen. But yes, that was a long time ago. That was way before 2020. When it says, I'm sorry.
So I'll tell you, Rav in our shul mentioned the story, and he said it like Dr. Shapiro did, that you know, this happened. And I said, wait a minute, you know, it was on a Shabbos afternoon. I said, let me send you the link to this talk. And he listened to the link and he said, I am now convinced that maybe it didn't happen and probably it didn't happen. I'm not going to tell the story again. So that's what I have to say on that.
I'm very impressed that I forgot.
You know, I forgot in Schneer's talk when I said it. I was just recording because of Rechek of Weinberg and so many others quoted. But now that you remind me, yes, he shows that it's a very complicated history to that story. But the Maskilim liked the story because it showed where he saw Salanter as one able to stand up against the closed-minded rabbis and, you know, that
right.
sort of thing.
But that's I think that's his point. They propagated it. They caused it, and they propagated it. They liked the story because it shows that, you know, you don't have – in the right circumstance, you can – you can eat on Yom Kippur.
Listen, they tried to get Rabbi Yisrael Salanter had to flee Vilna. They wanted him to become rabbi of their rabbinical seminary because they thought, here, he's so open-minded and he's speaking about things that they were speaking about, the need for Bein Adam Lechaver, all that. So they said, well, why don't you become head of our rabbinical seminary? Of course, he cannot be head of their rabbinical seminary. That was like a Russian institution designed to bring enlightenment to the Jew. It was the first step before, you know, like assimilation. But they really, just like the Maskilim, felt the Vilna Gaon because he was interested in Hebrew language and grammar and mathematics. The Maskilim like to look to these figures and pull them into their camp. Okay, look, we're just getting, as the song says, we've only just begun. And thank you all for joining us, Rabbi Kellman.
Thank you. And yes, I do agree. I think we'll
throw in Rabbi Kellman, I have a question.
Oh, Alan Bernstein, wait 1 minute. We'll get to you in 1 second. But yes, thank you very much. Right. And, you know, we'll find out about the Musar and the Musar dispute. Tomorrow, of course, Rabbi Shulman will be continuing his classes on Kohelet. Wednesday, Rabbi Helfgott on Malachim Bay. Thursday, Susan Hornstein is giving the Parsha Shir this week. Friday, my Shir on the Siddur. Rabbi Avia Tabori is also speaking on Thursday, the last of his classes on from challenges, halakhic challenges in Israel. And of course, I just put on the, in the chat box to register for our Sunday program on Purim. Okay, Alan, what do you want to ask?
So I really enjoyed it. I came late. It was an interesting class.
Okay, thank you, Alan.
Hey, Alan. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you all, and until next week.
Yeah, okay, everybody be well. Lila Tov. Yeah, Alan, we'll speak later. Thank you.
So...
Okay, Lila, tell everybody.